Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, doing all that social media stuff to get the word out about us, the National Coast Guard Museum, and our guests and how epic the Coast Guard and all of its veterans are. So thank you guys for that.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. If it's your first time, we're glad you found us. This is still kind of a new thing for us to do these crowdcasts. So if you're watching us, that's awesome. We're glad to have you. And if you're listening, we're still glad to have you. You're going to love what you hear today. When you're done, go back, listen to some of our older episodes. After you really like that too, please make sure to like us, subscribe to us, follow us on all your social media platforms, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Go to a browser, type in They Had to Go Out, and you'll find us. And remember those 5-star reviews.
Yes, those are the most important. And hey, as we say all the time, we will now give you a reason to do all that stuff for us. So who we've got on the line today, I love her her tagline. Happened to see a book cover with her name on it come across and reached out, and we're able to connect on social media. And the tagline for her bio right now, speaker, leader, author, captain, U.S. Coast Guard, retired. I love it. Very cool. So we've got on the line today Martha Cotite. Born and raised in New Orleans, actually raised in Destin, Florida. She's an Academy grad, class of 1980, we'll leave it blank. And then Coast Guard, first assignment, we're just playing, she didn't want to tell us at first, but first assignment was the Coast Guard Cutter Resolute out of Astoria, Oregon, and then as XO of the Coast Guard Cutter Padre down in Key West. She then went to Group Key West as the Assistant Operations Officer, Public Affairs in Seattle, and then Activities New York Surface Forces, where she transitioned to the Reserves. Here's where things start to get interesting, I think. Went to D1 Public Affairs and then Government Affairs at the sector post 9/11, Contingency Planning after 9/11, Emergency Preparedness Liaison at Headquarters, down to Sector Mobile as a Senior Reserve Officer, and did something so good as a reserve probably 05 at the time that she was asked to serve as the Commandant's Press Secretary, and served in that role from the Haiti earthquake all the way to the Deepwater Horizon. And then even during the Deepwater Horizon, you know, was again did so well that they transitioned her to active duty, and she served as the press officer for the Commandant of the Coast Guard at the time, Thad Allen. So what a time to, if you're ever going to be in a press leadership role, what a time to do it. So can't wait to talk to her about that and about her early time on the boat. She went, you know, from all the action to senior reserve officer in D9, where it probably really got squirrely, and that was her final assignment. And from there, she's went on to a host of really cool things that that definitely speak highly of the Coast Guard. So we're going to talk about all of them. Ma'am, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Phil and Bill. Right. I'm to be here, and thanks for the invitation.
No, thanks. Thanks for being here, ma'am. We appreciate it.
Bill, you got to ask the question. Your turn.
I do. I got thrown off. I don't know. It's this live show thing. With that, ma'am, and I'm looking forward to the answer on this one, because you had jobs I didn't even know existed until right now. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, thanks for that question. That's a very, very big question. especially we have to go back in time. But I want to start out, because Phil, you shared with me the other day that May is the centennial year of the Coast Guard Chief. This May,
yes, ma'am.
I think it's May 12th, celebrates 100 years of chiefs in the Coast Guard. And I just want to give a shout out to the chiefs who have served, those I've served with, those who have retired. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for making a difference for so many. And those that I've served with have been my mentors, my guides, my words of wisdom when I needed it most. And I can't thank you all enough for what your role is and how you serve.
Awesome, Martha. Thank you. Yeah, I'm sure.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd like to start with a couple stories. They each shaped my career as an officer and then a writer. And then I became a speaker. So each became a catalyst for the other. And they were unexpected events too, to become a writer and a speaker. So when I was in college at the Coast Guard Academy, we called it the factory, on a summer cadet cruise, I was sent down to Key West to serve on a 110-foot patrol boat. But these were unique ones. There was only three of them that existed in the Coast Guard, and they're called surface effect ships. So as I said, they're 110 feet long, but they're really wide. I think it was like 40 feet wide. And they were originally built as oil rig crew boats. And they had these eight fingers that would fill with air underneath the hull. And when we filled those with air, we would rise up and our draft would be 5 feet. When we collapsed, either unexpectedly or as requested, our air cushions would come down and our draft would be 8 feet. So Key West and the areas that we patrol were really hot in the late 80s for drug running. And in fact, one day we were on the boat and we were thought to be the mothership, and an aircraft flew over and dropped barrels of cocaine to us. And it was quite shocking to see the delivery like that.
Easiest drug bust ever.
It's raining.
Yeah, that was eye-opening.
And what year were you in, ma'am?
Hot and bright sunny day.
What year were you in at the academy when that happened?
Paysal Bank, which is a shallow area surrounded by sandy cays and islands, sort of a desert-like environment, 55 miles south of Florida and about 30 miles north of Cuba. So I was on the bridge, and I'm just a cadet from the academy, right? What do I know? And I look out on the horizon and I get excited because we see a sail. It's a brown sail over a wooden sailboat in the distance. And I'm like, yay, we get to help somebody. So the wise crew responded saying, well, you're not going to be saying that by the end of the day. Mm. And I was like, what? How could that possibly be? So as we approach the sailboat, we notice it was extremely overloaded and unsafe. And there appeared to be about 45 men, women, children, and a few babies on board. And they were like layered down into the hull of the wood vessel. And it was, they'd been underway for about 30 days, they said. And you could smell that smell from people being in a boat crammed in it like that for so much time. And so our goal was to make them safe and help them get off the boat. There were a couple folks on board that knew about what happens when you leave the boat that you're in, that you sailed from Haiti, risking your life for freedom in America, that you will be sent back. mm-hmm. to Haiti eventually. So the wise ones said, we're not going. We don't want anything to do with you, Coast Guard. Leave us alone. So this went on for a few hours. There were some very dramatic and heart-wrenching moments, like when they held the baby over the small engine that was powering the vessel when they weren't under sail. And as they were heading towards one of these sandy islands, they held the baby over and threatened to throw the baby into the engine area if we proceeded to come closer. And then at one point, they cut the neck off of a chicken, some sort of a voodoo ritual, which was to ward off any bad spirits. So things really got crazy, and they made it to shore with one of these sandy islands. And by that time, we had some immigration and naturalization agents on board, and we had permission to enter Bahamian waters. And so I remember seeing the agents go to shore to talk to some of the men who were the leaders of this group who had no intention of getting on board our boat. And apparently they were repeat migrants. So they had done this before. They knew the deal. And at some point them off their boat and bring them on board the Coast Guard cutter Seahawk. And we searched them as they came on board. We checked their hair into a cove with this big, and Ben Wingo had climbed to the top of this hilly peak, and his strobe light was flashing on his life jacket. And that's how they spotted him. And his three shipmates had been lost and perished, in part due to the many times that the motor lifeboat had rolled over and righted itself as it was designed to do. It would roll and rewrite itself. And these brave men lost their lives, risking their lives to save these two people on the sailboat. So this became a national story, and an investigation followed. And this was sadly the first fatal capsizing of this type of rescue boat in its 35-year history. So this is, again, another story of people going out, people in the Coast Guard risking their lives for others. And it certainly touched me and has remained with me to this day. And I think we've learned a lot from it. And so I said three stories. The third one also begins when I was in the Pacific Northwest as the District Public Affairs Officer. So I had served 6 years in the Coast Guard at this point, over 3 years at sea, and I thought I knew a lot. I thought I knew most things about the Coast Guard, and heck, I'm in public affairs telling our stories. In fact, one of my first patrols on my first cutter, the MEC, medium endurance cutter, was the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So I thought I'd seen a lot and done a lot, and gosh, what do I not know? Well, I walked into the shop one day, and my public affairs chief was telling me what they were working on, and I was like, what, run that by me again? Well, they were working on a reenactment of a rescue that took place in an Oregon cave near Cape Lookout, and that a Coast Guard helicopter had flown into the cave to help pull out the rescue swimmer who had saved one of the survivors. The other person that was in the cave before the rescue swimmer got there had passed tragically. And I thought, a helicopter from the Coast Guard flying into a cave? When does that happen? How is that possible? So I dove into that story more, and I was just enthralled by it, and it just grabbed hold of me and stuck with me. And years later, I was still thinking about it, and I resolved that if I didn't know about that story and other stories of such amazing things that our men and women in the Coast Guard have done and the things that they have achieved with bravery and courage, then America sure doesn't know. And this was long before Katrina, so we really were not on the map, if you will. And it was also a time when you didn't have social media, you didn't have immediate news and capability to put your story out there like everyone can now. Everyone now is a storyteller with their cameras and phones. So later when I transitioned from Seattle to New York and I transferred into the reserves, I was working in the city, and then 9/11 happened. So I had a little more time on my hands because I lost my corporate job. And I thought, I'm going to write this book. And of course, it took more than just saying it. It was a couple years. But the first story that I wrote, which became the book called So Others May Live, Coast Guard Rescue Swimmers Saving Lives Defying Death, was chapter 5, which is Tristan Heaton's story. And this book is a collection of 11 legendary rescues to honor the service of our men and women by showcasing and documenting for history's sake the things that they have done to save a stranger by risking their own life.
Awesome, man. Wow. I love it.
Hey, yeah, I'm stuck on the helicopter flying into the cave. I need to read that now.
Yeah, for sure.
It's an incredible, incredible story. I think now they've added that to the training list of here's how you train for people that are in caves so that the helicopters don't have to go in now.
don't have to fly in.
Part of our evolution. Like, we're innovative, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm sure you guys as chiefs can talk about some of the innovations that you've witnessed or created so that we improve what we do and how we do it.
Get all the way back to when you were the cadet on that experimental vessel. What year were you in at the academy? And then what was your role aboard the ship? Because I don't know if too many people know what that cadets get that experience.
I would think that this was probably my junior year at the academy, because then we got to go and do really cool things. And so I was assigned to a ship with a crew of 16, and the captain was an officer. Everyone else was enlisted. I don't recall who the XO was at this point. But my role was to learn, observe, participate, and do as much as possible to, it's a, sort of an immersion and introduction to being on board a Coast Guard patrol boat. It was really.
Did you send QMO watch, ma'am, or did they let you, were you breaking in OOD at that point, or?
That's a good question. It was five weeks, and it really is all a blur.
My guess is QMO. That's what we always had our cadets do in my experience, but just wasn't sure if you remembered or not.
It's funny because I'm thinking, you know, like when you rounded your career out at District 9, at a station in D9, the experience for a cadet is much different than a patrol boat out of Key West. So, yeah, you were set up for success early, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll speak to it, Phil, as having, you know, been enlisted on an MEC. We used to love getting the cadets that were, you know, juniors about to be seniors, because they could augment watch sections and they really were like kind of fully part of the crew. It was actually kind of a help. And they really got a lot out of it. When we would get them and they were like a freshman going to be a sophomore, they were more like non-rates for us. That was how we were told to treat them. Is that how it was in your day as well, ma'am?
Yeah, I think I feel the same way. It was totally welcome. We were welcomed. I was welcome to be a part of the crew and they taught us a lot, showed us a lot, and it was wonderful.
Well, and you made somebody's watch rotation better, so that's why they were glad to have you, for sure.
For sure. Just summed it up, Bill, right there, right? You're like, I'm going to put the reality on this. You're filling a role.
Well, no, good. But it's a helpful role. Like, it's very helpful. I don't know.
16 people. We're talking 16 people on a cutter. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hours in the day for 16 people to cover.
Right. Yeah. And two of them are probably cooks, or at least one of them was a cook. So.
Right.
Yeah.
I definitely got to know the cook. That was a lot of fun. And yeah. And with 16 people and a hot, heavy, you know, quick pace, fast pace, operations tempo, there's a lot to do.
For sure. How many, when you had your migrant riot, how many migrants did you guys have on board at that time? Do you remember roughly?
The little story I told that.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Thinking it was mid 40s, like 40.
Okay, so you were wildly outnumbered at that point. Yeah.
Wildly outnumbered, and they were going to take over the ship.
Right.
None of them made it to the bridge, thank goodness, because I would have been, what do I do?
Well, that's what I thought the best part of that story was when the, you know, they came to find you, right? And they're like, cadet, you know, come up to the bridge. The captain needs you. And then, you know, if the captain told you, you know, they're getting violent or whatever, they're going to take over the ship. The way it was framed, right, almost makes it seem like I can't imagine what was going through your head. Like, well, I don't know. What do we do? Like, start throwing people overboard? Like, what's next, Captain? I have no idea. Standing by for your orders, right? Like, you tell me, ma'am or sir.
Yeah, I had no law enforcement training. I had no weapons. Right. I was just driving a boat.
Yeah. So how did they react to that? I mean, do you, you know, what was the, how did they do it? How did they quell the kind of mutiny or the takeover?
Well, that's the funny thing is because I had to stay there and drive, right? It wasn't right. like I could look over the bridge wing or look down on deck. So I was not getting information. I'm like, I hope they're okay.
You just glued to the helm, like, right? Right. I mean, yeah, I believe it right. for sure.
So it was like, what's going on? It was terrifying. And I kept asking for information and no one would really talk to me. They're like, they're in focusing on what's going on too, right?
Right.
And, so it just seemed like an hour or whatever went by, and finally it was like, Captain, are you okay? Is everybody okay? Yeah, we took care of it. We won the battle.
We took care of it. It's just over.
Well, and you know, the amazing thing is I think especially in the days when we had a really heavy migrant load, that happened more commonly than probably most people understand. Because I've heard a lot of stories. Different crews like, oh yeah, we had a migrant riot for this or that or the other thing kind of thing.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And if you put yourself in their shoes and you've risked everything, you've sold everything for passage on this boat and you've lost lives and you've been underway for 30 or more days, you don't want to be on a Coast Guard cutter. You're almost there. You're almost in America, land of the free. So I can't blame them.
No, certainly they had something to lose that they almost got there. And I mean, I don't know if you ever got the chance. I imagine you probably did when you were on the 110, ma'am, to actually see Haiti. I think I'd probably get on a raft and try to get over here too.
Right. But the funny thing, I was thinking about it as I was preparing to tell the story. I'm like, well, what? In my mind, I always wanted to know, well, what were they planning on doing if they did succeed? Now, not that they would.
Right.
They could have, but what would they do with a Coast Guard patrol boat?
Right.
That's a great question. That's a quality question right there. What would they do with it? I bet they wouldn't go back to Cuba.
Right. It's like the old story about the guy who steals the cop car, wakes up the next morning with it in his garage. Like, you don't know, what do you do?
What do you do? Just walk away.
Right.
Right.
Oh, man. Yeah, and that's, I mean, what an introduction to the Coast Guard, you know, going to that. And these aren't, you know, a lot of, I would say 90% of migrant interactions probably even then were compliant, right? You kind of, you're there with an overwhelming show of force just because of the cutter and the crew and the professionalism. And then you happen to get a pretty defiant bunch that were not having it. And then to see the humanity of it all, I'm sure, you know, the humanity of that just hitting anyone that's younger, it definitely brings it home that the word migrant means something. I mean, these people are, like you said, are risking it all. You got children involved. You've got just a lot of passion, a lot of fear that they don't want to go back. So I could imagine how that was. What about the baby? What did the baby do? Like when you saw the child on board, did that, you know, that trigger anything?
Yeah, I mean, I still see the baby in my mind when I think about it, and the person holding the baby over the engine, and you know, they're willing to risk everything for what they had set out to do, and it's really sad to see that people are in those situations in the world, and we are so fortunate, we are so blessed, and we had to do what we were mandated to do by our government. And
I always wonder, so, you know, from a public affairs standpoint later on in your career, now that you've seen this, right, you've seen what it's like, you know, we know the law, our job is to enforce the law, right, when you're out there, but mm-hmm. To have to defend it, you know, publicly may be a different story, you know, especially given different circumstances that happen, because nothing's ever, never seems to be easy and just black and white, you know, just put it neatly in a box and put it away. People ask questions and some of them have harder answers. So did you take that experience? Did that play into any public affairs actions that you took later in your career?
Well, I think I would always lean on our legal expertise, our legal team, wherever I was assigned, to ask them to give me guidance on how can I answer this question? How can I do this? What are the legal foundations for what we are doing and the actions that we're taking? So yeah, we're in a slang sort of fashion, we're cops on the water. There's laws that we need to enforce, and certainly we have to check all the boxes to do it in the right and proper way and a humanitarian way.
Did you ever look at Border Patrol's public affairs and just shake your head? Sometimes, I'm just kidding. I'm joking. just a joke.
It's a tough situation to be in.
No, for sure. I don't envy, the explanation's hard. The law's there. It's black and white, but the execution can always be a little dicey sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the advantage we have, if I can interject, I think the advantage the Coast Guard has is we can always fall back on. We're protecting that safety of life at sea. Mm-hmm. Because they're probably not going to make it to shore, and we're probably going to legitimately have bodies wash up on our shores if the Coast Guard's not out there doing that. We're actually keeping people alive by doing that. It's probably a little harder for Border Patrol to maybe in some cases spin it in a different way.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's my point, right, is that Border Patrol, I mean, someone saw it. Someone, like you said earlier, ma'am, someone had a camera, you know, it was there. It wasn't hundreds of miles out to sea and right off the territorial waters of someone else.
Right.
Yeah, wild.
And I agree with you. We definitely have to look at what can we do to help people when they're on the water. How do we help them stay safe so that they don't lose their life? That's priority number one.
Life jackets are always the talking point, right? If all else fails, like, are you guys wearing your life jackets? Isn't that the public affairs line?
That's right.
Yeah. I love it. Makes it easy. If nobody knows that, that's it. Like, if all else fails and a reporter asks you a question, just
fall back on the importance of PFDs.
Yeah, make sure you're wearing your life jacket. Everyone wear a life jacket, please. You can never go wrong.
That's right.
Ma'am, when you were at the sector in the Pacific Northwest and you dealt with the tragedy on the motor lifeboat, who did you work for at the time? Was it the sector or the district?
I was at the district, so I worked for the admiral of the district.
Okay. So, I mean, what was the admiral's involvement as far as, I mean, we just had, you know, three Coast Guard members lose their lives on a boat. Do you know who made the notifications or, you know, were you involved in any of that, like notifying the media, notifying the family?
No, I was not involved with the family. Mm-hmm. But my responsibilities were the basis of public relations, public affairs, is helping people understand what's going on and what are we doing to make a difference? How are we there to help them? And in our case, what happened to our own? Mm-hmm. So certainly it was a remote location where this went down. It was extremely dangerous weather when this happened, and it was in the early morning hours. So there was a lot of darkness. So there wasn't a lot of, and there was no communication. So what did you have to go on? Time would tell. So time would give us the information that we needed. People going out and looking, walking the shoreline, looking for things. Helicopter flying and observing, besides rescuing the people. So my job was, as we got information, getting it out there as in an appropriate way. So if the families weren't notified yet, we certainly weren't releasing names of people, of our brave, courageous men who had died. And I think for a long time too, I don't know that we released the name of the survivor because they were, you know, they were a crew together. You can't release one name and not release the rest. It was a huge case, a huge sad story. It was something that went on for weeks, if not months, in terms of the after actions, the investigation, how could something like this happen? And the media interest was intense. And so I cooperated and worked with my colleagues back in headquarters, Washington, D.C., Coast Guard headquarters, public affairs. And at some point, I think they flew out a couple people to help too with the massive interest from media, certainly nationally, if not a few international outlets.
Yeah, I can't imagine. What an event to have to, you know, and that's a localized one too. Like you said, we were talking a remote area of the country, but but a Coast Guard lifeboat failing, kind of, you know, in a sense.
I just know the impact that event's had on the Coast Guard, man. I mean, as soon as you started talking, I went, oh, I know exactly. And that was 7-8 years before I even joined. As soon as you started mentioning, you know, the year and the what. Everybody knows that story, I think, now in the Coast Guard. So what a major thing it really was.
And it was heart-wrenching. It was so sad. I mean, we were all, you know, trying to hold it together. I didn't know these people, but you know how close we are as a Coast Guard family.
Right.
You don't have to know someone to feel it. And then the memorial service was really beautiful. We had it out at Station Quileute River, and the Secretary of Transportation, we were under transportation at the time, came out for that. It was a wonderful tribute. And I still remember to this day, there's a bronze memorial to the crew and to the motor lifeboat at Station Quileute River that was beautifully done. Certainly you can't replace what was lost, and that's still a tragedy to this day, but it's nice that they were honoring them with this memorial.
Very, mm-hmm. I'd never heard of the service. I've read the book. There's a website now that a young surfman did and researched and recently put up on it. And then I saw, I think District Public Affairs, maybe Coast Guard Public Affairs, put out a video with the survivor, and he talks about it. And he's now a chief aviation maintenance technician. So. A very, very powerful story coming from him. And it's always interesting to get new angles on it from everybody that was involved, including yourself. So very, very cool to hear.
I'll have to look that up. I heard he did go into aviation. Can't blame him, right?
Yeah. He said he needed a quieter, you know, just a quieter job. I get it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding. Oh. She's like, yeah, really? Like... No.
I mean, I bought it, Phil.
Yeah, we got to talk smack on air deals sometimes.
Right.
Survivors or not, you know.
Right.
So, man, let's talk your command tour, your XO tour. You're coming on as the number two of the boat. You are, you know, I can kind of imagine what it feels like to get your bars coming out of the academy and receiving your commission and walking out to that first unit, because now you're not a cadet anymore. Now you're someone that's in charge. But in a command role as a executive officer, the number two on the cutter, how did you go into that job? You know, like what was your feeling? Like what were your plans? Or I'm just curious.
Well, it was a very interesting time. I was excited about the job. I was honored by the opportunity, and certainly it was a very prestigious position to be assigned as second in command of a patrol boat anywhere in the Coast Guard. And this one just happened to be in Key West. So when I get on board, I come to find out, you know, you get to learn who the people are that you're serving with. And the captain at the time didn't want me on board. And there had never been a woman on that patrol boat before. And he certainly didn't want me. And one of the earliest patrols, the chief and I, chief engineer, and I were, he nosed the patrol boat up to the dock at Key West, said, both of you leave, we'll see you later. And turned the boat around and went back out and did circles in the Caribbean and the Atlantic, came back, and we're like, are you guys okay? What happened? So there were some issues going on with the captain and things going on in his life that I was not a part of or privy to. So that was my welcoming experience.
Yeah, wow. Huh? Wow. Gosh.
So it's hard to say you have a plans or agenda when you're not wanted. But thankfully, the CO transitioned out, and the CO that came in was a phenomenal leader and person and gave me every opportunity to succeed as an officer and to do my job as a professional as I was assigned and planned to do. And that's why I'm in the Coast Guard, right? So it was a wonderful experience. And I really always fall back on that tour thinking about how amazing it was to serve in that capacity with this crew. We became a tight-knit crew. the enlisted folks had my back, I had theirs, and, you know, a little side story. I was terrified, even though I'd gone to boarding officer school and I had the 9mm on my hip and the body armor on and all this stuff when you go to do a boarding. I was terrified of going to do these boardings with the guns because I always thought, well, what if something goes wrong? I have to apply those defensive techniques and all this and that. But I was so blessed that the team I would go with, one of them in particular was a bosun mate. And actually, you might know him, J.R. Knob. Mm. He's a civilian now at headquarters, does security.
Oh, okay. Have you been to headquarters recently?
Not in a while.
Okay, we got to call him up and just be like, hey, can you smooth the process for all of us next time we visit?
Just a little bit.
Just like one less metal detector, maybe. But at least right. Hey, we've got an in now. We've got an in. That's awesome.
Yeah, we should call him right now and get him on the line. But anyway, so you know how you just have that feeling about someone? So I felt I could trust him and the other members of our boarding team, and I could do my job because I know they had my back. So the fear factor settled down after a while, and it really is about a team. It's really about working together, and it's such a fast-paced, exhausting, but exciting and adventurous tour. It was just a thrill. It was just so wonderful. I hope I answered your question. I don't even remember what your question was.
No, you did. You absolutely did.
For sure. I mean,
like a whole series of lessons, right? I mean, you went from something that was really challenging and negative and probably a little destructive to your mindset to the complete opposite. So, you know, awesome how that happened. What lessons do you say would you take from the bad leader? Are you one of those people that just you just don't want to mimic what they did, or you know, what would you have done differently, I guess?
If I was the captain or as the executive officer?
Just having seen the lessons from your initial treatment when you walked aboard, what lesson did you take away? What would you have done differently?
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't treat someone that way.
Fair enough.
They've earned the spot, and the gender doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's some of the rules of engagement I talk about now, is be bold, be first, and be you. And being bold is about a leader that is empathetic, has candor, wants to know what his or her people need to be successful. A bold leader is vulnerable, willing to take feedback. And I think that just creates a culture of empowerment. And when you have empowerment, what can't you do? You can achieve anything you set your mind out to do. And that's being on a patrol boat, being a member of a team. It's about success and getting to where you need to be. So I think building a culture of empowerment, allowing people to be themselves, that was the be you part, being authentic to who you are, what your goals are, your passions are, so that you can drive towards that. And as a leader, knowing what your team needs so that they can be them, certainly following guidelines because we're all in the military, and being first. In my case, I was the first woman, but it shouldn't matter if you're first. It could be the first to follow, because we don't know everything, right? Like even now, We don't have the answers to everything going on with the pandemic. So maybe we need to fall back on the expertise of those that are on our team, who may be junior. It's not about rank. Maybe they have some solutions so we can redefine who we are and where we're going. So
great way to tie it into current affairs, ma'am. Sure. I like it. Yeah. From my perspective, at least, the Coast Guard of today versus the Coast Guard that I joined long ago, I don't feel, at least, that we see gender near as much as in past years. It just doesn't seem to be a topic, at least at the deck plate level. When people report, I'm not going to say there's not issues, because I know that there are, right? But at the same token, I think on a professional standpoint, I don't see what I saw when I first joined. No one's like, oh, the new girl's here or something. It's just, hey, we've got a new, we've got a new lieutenant, we've got a new PO3, whatever it is. What's your take on has the Coast Guard advanced in the way that it deals with gender?
Oh, absolutely. The reason I joined the Coast Guard was I learned before I joined that all missions were open to men and women. They weren't restricted based on gender. So I feel the Coast Guard has demonstrated a trailblazing methodology and practice in terms of changing policies that were restrictive, allowing men and women to serve equally. So yes, we've been a pace setter, a trailblazer. Other services are following us on some of the things that we've done, like the care for newborn child and the sabbatical programs, where anyone, male or female, can take a sabbatical for whatever the reason to take care of life. That's important.
For sure. I bet it's funny. I'm thinking back to, probably your younger self, and you're thinking the Coast Guard's really advanced, but then you're not realizing too, I'm going to be the first one, the first female XO of this patrol book. But way to own it and to make it better, and then, make it far better when you left, I think, than when you got there, it sounds like.
Well, thank you. And it was a team effort. I couldn't have done it alone. And I certainly didn't do it alone.
So let's move on to, I know you've had some interactions with one of our guests, one of my personal heroes, a personal hero for a lot of us, Bill Lass, because it was like a groupie or something.
We were just starstruck the whole time.
Yeah, we were. Like, it was terrible. But so excited that we got to talk to Admiral Allen, but you got to talk to him every day, at least on a much more regular basis than we did. Talk to us about when you came on to his staff and how that was, because it was definitely in a very chaotic time, I would think.
It was. It was totally unexpected. I don't think anyone plans for an earthquake to happen the fourth day that they're on the job, and this earthquake was in Haiti. And I just drove. I can't speak correct English. I drove from Florida to Washington, D.C. with my car full of household stuff and packed into an apartment and showed up for work. And then on the fourth day, the Haiti earthquake happened. And then at the tail end of my assignment was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So when Admiral Allen was wrapping up his tenure as commandant, we had a change of command, and the Deepwater Horizon overlapped that couple week period in April before his actual retirement ceremony. So we crossed over from Commandant to Deepwater Horizon, working together as well. So what a great leader, like you said. It was an honor and a blessing to be a part of his team. I thought it was interesting. I'll brag a little bit on the Reserve Corps. So here I am, a reserve officer coming in on active duty to work with this A-list staff. And so every now and then I thought, well, has any other reservist done this? I don't know of any other reservist serving on the Commandant staff. But hopefully there were others, but I'm not aware of it. So
continuing to be a trailblazer, man.
Yep, that's it.
Well, it was quite a compliment to me, and I'm just showing you how high that bar was.
No, it should be, I don't know, like for anyone that doesn't realize the gender improvement and the gender trailblazing that the Coast Guard does not apply to Coast Guard reservists. Not the gender part, but just Coast Guard reservists are viewed are viewed a totally different way, I think. In
they're not given the value they probably should.
That's a good way to put it. There you go. That's the way to put it.
Exactly. And guess who witnessed that transitioning from active duty to reserves?
Right, at the highest level, too, right?
Right.
You can't pull that one on me. Listen, I know what you're doing here.
Yep.
I came from active duty. So, what a great leader. I thoroughly enjoyed setting up interviews for him, talking through strategy, preparing, I'm trying to remember what it was called. It was a little black book that we had an engagement that I either pitched or someone came to us. We had to do briefing papers on it in advance, write a script. And of course, he didn't really need a script written for him. He could, he could just talk, but it was kind of like busy work. We had to put it into the binder and give it to him. And what a wonderful person and human being, phenomenal champion of others as well.
And did you go down? Did you have to go? Like, where were you at in all this physically? Where was your physical location throughout most of it? Were you traveling? Like, how did that work out?
The old headquarters location was where we started out.
Okay.
And so from there, if we were going, if it was a drive, then we had the motorcade, if you will, with his security forces. We'd jump in the car and I'd usually be in the second car and wouldn't necessarily be in the same car as the commandant. I was the B row,
the B row.
And then if it was something further away, I remember we did fly to a couple different places on the jet, which was a Gulfstream, which was phenomenal.
Right. What's it like in there? We just talked to a pilot the other day, and I swear I thought it was like the Falcon or whatever that flies them. And she's like, no. That's CGX-1 or whatever. So what's it like in that thing?
Just like what you would imagine, watch a show about a gazillion. And I think one of my favorite silly moments, I do a lot of silly things, was the person that helps in the cabin, brings you drinks.
Like the stewardess?
But it was a coastie.
Yeah. Oh, like
it's
a steward.
It's like a flight attendant. It's like a mess attendant at that point.
Mess attendant.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you put a name on that. You can label that. So this person said, would you like something to eat or drink? And I was like, well, what do you have? And it's close to takeoff, right? So we're buckled in. I'm in my leather chair, sitting by the window.
Reclined.
And we're almost, yeah. Right. And I said, well, maybe I asked for a soda. And he's, what kind of snack would you like? I'm like, well, what do you have? And he said, M&Ms, that sounds great, M&Ms. You know, and so that brings out the drink and the M&Ms, and I open it up and I set it on the table. And then before I know it, we're taking off. And this takeoff, you don't have to put your drinks or M&Ms away when you take off. So the incline is like this. It's like almost vertical in seconds. My M&Ms are going all the way down, rolling down the plane. And I'm so embarrassed. And they're like, that's LaGuardia. Yep.
That's good.
This is why we don't let you fly.
Can't take her out.
That's awesome.
We got to remember that, Bill, if we ever get invited on that thing. We no M&Ms prior to takeoff.
It's important. I'm willing to go ahead and probably forget that because I think the odds are slim.
Yeah, me too. But I would be, like, how embarrassing. I could imagine. Like, you would totally turn around. I'd be mortified. Oh, man, yeah. Or something so trivial, right? Like, my M&Ms fell off the table. But, yeah.
Or you could pull a LaGuardia and ask for M&Ms.
Right, yeah, and just do it on purpose.
I'll just remember not to open them until after we're at cruising altitude. Right.
See, a chief would think of that. That's why
I learned that from you. I never would have thought of that.
I wouldn't have either, no way. That's pretty good. So when the transition happened, man, with the so basically there were two commandants at one time. And what a weird kind of situation. There was one commandant, but we also had the National Incident Commander for Deepwater Horizon. So Admiral Allen was still around, and it was from the deck plate perspective, it was almost like
two popes.
Yeah, like what are we going to do now? You know, you're just looking around like who's in charge. How did you guys kind of navigate that one? Or what did, was it viewed as a, like an issue at all, among the public affairs staff?
Well, we had an awareness that visually that might be the case.
Right.
That there's the commandant who just came in and the commandant who just retired, but now is national commander, and such a, you know, a very visible leader. But physically, there were different structures set up immediately, like different rooms and places to work. You go to this different floor. So the structure was set up to remove that and separate the two areas of responsibility. And so for public affairs, we also divided and conquered, and we brought in more staff. So there was a big cell built out, because as you can, as you probably remember, it was a massive media story. So I stayed in Washington, D.C., and then we had another officer go down range to Louisiana, where the, I want to say the forward command post was, and worked with Admiral Landry downrange. So we sort of split the lines of effort and tried to stay engaged so that we had the right talking points. We were all talking the same message and working with state, federal, responsible party, other political entities, answering their questions, as well as the press. So it was a big deal. It was a big deal. And, I, when it was time for me to go, cause I had completed my assignment, and when the Admiral became the NIC, I stayed on just a little bit longer. And then I was able to transition back home, and I got a friend from, one of my reserve colleagues. He mentioned to me, he says, "Hey, Martha, this is an all hands on deck evolution." Even though the oil hadn't come to Florida yet, it was more focused on the Louisiana impacts. He says, "You're going to be called in." And I thought, well, if I'm going to be called in, why don't I just raise my hand now? Because I know the spots in Florida need to be filled. So I raised my hand. I said, I'll stand up. I'll serve." Even though I'd just come off 6 months, you know, that's unusual for a reservist to serve that long of a time. I served two or three more months in Florida, and I started out with two counties because they needed both. And then as it got busier, we had to split it up, and I was one county. So yeah, it's a whole nother dynamic, a whole nother way of managing public affairs and politics. We're, you know, totally embedded in that, not in terms of how we did our job, but you could just tell there was a lot of force from politics to tell the stories in certain ways, because that was, it was a big political story too, across the nation.
And how did you get into public affairs in the first place, ma'am? So you went from XO of the, you know, I know you transitioned to the reserves. Is that kind of what like predicated the transition?
I'm so glad you asked.
No. Yeah, all right, for sure.
No, it was interesting. The way it started for me was on my first tour, the MEC 210-foot cutter, the Resolute. We sailed from Astoria, Oregon to Prince William Sound for the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So this was, what is it, 1989, and into the mid-90s. Was anybody in the military talking to media, volunteering stories, giving out photos and pitching stories? No, it was not a thing back then.
Right.
And it certainly wasn't a highly thought of job to be a public affairs officer in the military. It was given to people that were on their way out or messed something up, ironic. So back to the cutter, first patrol, we're dealing with this massive oil spill, the biggest of its kind at the time, the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And the ships was looking for someone to be the public affairs officer. It was a collateral duty. No one raised their hand. And I,
here you go, Ensign.
Yeah, there you go, Guardia. But I actually said, I'll do it. And right. For me, I'm a people person. And I like the idea of, hey, I'll go to Whittier. I'll go to Homer. I'll meet with the people. I'll tell them what we're doing. I'll get the information, and I love writing, right? So it was so cool to actually write something besides messages and message traffic. I got to write press releases, interview people and tell the story and take pictures. So it was right down my alley, and it was my passion to tell our stories. And it, then it just grew more and more. As you can see, you know, I was always the collateral PAO. I learned a lot on the street, if you will, or on my own feet, and got mentored by people that knew more, which helped me develop my craft. And then I got the job even before they sent me to, they never sent me to grad school for public affairs, which was the irony, was really funny. They're like, oh, you know what you're doing. Go to the 5 day course and then go to Seattle. I'm like, okay.
It's the curse of being good at your job, right? You could have had the grad school if you hadn't already known what you were doing.
I know. I should have held out and said, no, I went to grad school.
rightfully so, though. It sounds like you hit all the, you were in for pretty much some of the biggest things that happened over that, you know, those two decades.
I actually have a question, man, that, having served on a 210 and having been at the kind of the deck plate level for some of the Deepwater Horizon, what were you doing on a 210 during the Exxon Valdez? Cause I know like most of the gear we were using in 2010 to clean up the oil in the Gulf was stuff that got built and designed because of our experience in the Exxon Valdez. So like, what did you guys have to do and what really was the cutter doing? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, this is going back a bunch of years. From what I can remember, we work with the Marine investigative teams from the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there were like hundreds of fishing vessels that were brought in to help put boom out, help with the onshore cleanup. I remember hot water being sprayed on the beaches, which were rocks like boulders, and you had to mm-hmm. tuck in, get the oil out with the hot water. So I remember our job was, as Coast Guard, was to supervise the cleanup, the mitigation, whether it was on the beach or on the water. So I think it was somewhat of a model for Deepwater Horizon, but certainly right. The equipment, there weren't enough skimmers and boom doesn't really work, but.
Right. Right. Now I was just curious. Like I said, I know most of the gear I used in deep water was stuff that again, came out of our experience in Exxon Valdez. So I wondered what we had to play with in those days, basically.
What did you do for deep water?
I was on an OSV offshore supply vessel that we had put the Voss system on. So I spent couple weeks at a time out there with a civilian crew, myself and one other coastie who every time was a reservist. I'll actually shout out to the reserves there. I said they're underappreciated. They were the backbone of the Deepwater Horizon response, at least in my experience. They vastly outnumbered those of us on active duty and literally just sat there in the oil, you know, sucking it up with a skimmer for days on end.
That was a big job and it was hot and uncomfortable.
It was the Gulf in July.
Mm-hmm.
You know what this whole conversation made me think of? Like, it, you know, so Deepwater or Exxon Valdez, we didn't have enough oil skimmers. And we had the same problem again, Deepwater Horizon. All I can think is like, I really need some TP, some masks, some gloves, and maybe a personal ventilator just in case, you know?
Right.
Just in case. Like, you never know what's going to happen. Yeah. Right. Ma'am, I was looking through your bio, too. You know, we were talking about the Coast Guard not funding grad school. It sounds like it worked out for you.
Well, the funny thing was I ended up realizing I needed grad school to get promoted, captain especially. So I was a little late in my career to go to grad school, but I utilized the post 9/11 GI Bill. And do you want me to tell you where I went?
Yeah, no, I see it. Yeah, tell everybody where you went. You should be proud of that. I would be. I mean, that's more ring. I don't know. I mean, there's got to be a class ring or something that you can knock. Can you knock both hands?
I can knock on my head.
There you are.
It's quite a build up here, Phil.
No,
it's, ma'am, you got
it. I'll tell her. Harvard grad. I mean, she went to Harvard. And what was your master's in, ma'am?
Journalism.
Awesome. Wow, very cool.
Right. So that goes back to be bold, be first, be you. So when I was transitioning from Seattle to New York, I was a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander. I think I was just putting on lieutenant commander. And the Coast Guard wanted me to go back to sea because I certainly had the resume to go back to sea. And they wanted me to go to grad school in public administration. And I'm like, well, what's that? I don't even know what that is. But I had my sights on what can I do in media relations, public affairs? And I wanted to be the Hollywood motion picture liaison officer. So that was like two ranks down the road and only one person would get it. And if I got the rank and the promotions, would I get the job? So I just didn't see it happening in my future. But I knew I wanted to follow my passion, to be me, and be bold by going into a field that wasn't highly regarded at the time versus going back to sea. Mm-hmm. And one other side story, I could have made a gazillion with my colleague so I was in D13, which is Seattle. My colleague was D1 Boston. We were both public affairs officers for our respective districts. And we were brainstorming about how do we get more of the Coast Guard on television shows, in magazines. We need video. So we developed a concept that we would put helmet cameras on the aviators' helmets so that when they fly missions, they could video the rescue. I'll be darned. Why didn't we think of GoPro back then?
Right. Yeah. Right. Like, that's all somebody needed. That's good. The funny side story, I got a new GoPro Max. I don't know if you've seen this camera.
It's, not a sponsor.
Dude, no, that thing is incredible, though. I've never seen anything like that. It's amazing. Anyway, side story, that's just me being excited over a new toy. I'm in quarantine, so like everybody should forgive me. Well, ma'am, I see too from your bio. So once you transitioned to, actually, one more question about your Coast Guard service. So in D9, you're the Reserve Affairs Officer, right? So did you manage summer stock?
We had a team of people, mm-hmm. So I was in the planning part of it. But certainly we turned over the execution to the senior enlisted, and the teams that would go out and do the job. So yeah, it was a great job to be in. People wanted to be part of summer stock, which is augmenting the active duty crews at these stations that get bombarded with activity just for the summer months, right? Did you do that?
I have been a beneficiary of summer stock many times. So there were a ton of really good people, whoever, you know, I don't know if there was a vetting process or what, but for some reason in D9, you got some of the most quality reservists to come out and really help move that mission. So to bootstomp what Bill said earlier, there are definitely, there are many great reservists out there. The widespread hate and discontent sometimes is misplaced. Admin, however, for them is always a nightmare. So if anybody can fix that, feel free. Yeah.
Yes.
That might get you more money than GoPro.
Right.
Yeah, if you can fix the reserve nightmare, I would be impressed. All right, ma'am. Well, so from there, I'm just reading your bio through. You talked at TEDx. Oh, did we lose her?
No, I'm here.
Okay, we got her. Yep, we got her back. So you talked at TEDx, ma'am. What was your talk on?
My TEDx talk was at the Defense Acquisitions University, and it was the theme was creating a culture of empowerment, actually, and it matched what their theme it complemented their theme, which was decisive edge. So I worked with a coach to decide how do I create a presentation that complements decisive edge based on the things that I like to talk about and my experiences. And so creating a culture of empowerment can give a team, a workplace, the military, a decisive edge. And so I spoke about that, and I utilized three stories from my book that I wrote about women in the military, which is called Changing the Rules of Engagement. It's a collection of inspiring stories of women who had served as trailblazers. They were courageous, they were brave, and they helped change the culture of a male-dominated military to be one where gender doesn't matter. And we're still trying to make progress that way, because I think only, 16% of the active duty military is women, which is not a very big number. So mm-hmm. There's still some work to be done, but the idea was to share these stories and show how each woman, including a little bit about my story, helped do things so that the culture became one of empowerment, which gives everyone a decisive edge when everyone's empowered and that gender doesn't matter.
Awesome. And I think it sounds like you had the perfect experience to draw on to write that and to speak speak intelligently on it. Very cool.
Thank you.
And I will say, like, I the culture of the military, at least from my perspective, has definitely changed for the better. And yeah, that's due to trailblazers, you know, like yourself, that took some of those hard jobs when they became available. So.
And I want to make sure that you guys know and the audience knows, I feel blessed and honored to have served in the Coast Guard. It's made me a stronger, better person. I've learned so much. I've done so many amazing things, and I would highly recommend it.
Awesome. Good answer. What
and a recruiting poster too. Awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of brings us to why. So I guess, sounds like personal experience led to that book. And I think that's your second, right? The one that we just talked about.
Yep. This is the second, Changing the Rules of Engagement.
Perfect. We'll link it all over the place. And then let's talk about So Others May Live. So I know, there we go. I know that you talked about the Oregon Cave. What beyond that, like what kind of spurred it? And then, oh, there's a third one. Let's see. Old Glory. What was the third one?
My name is Old Glory.
Awesome. Talk to us about that one. What's that one about? I got to know now.
Okay. So this one, have you guys been to a retirement ceremony where they read the poem? Yeah,
that was the first thing I thought
Absolutely, yeah. That's where my mind went to. Yeah.
Right.
And it was meant to be a book for children, but it apparently is the language is a little too high. So it's a great book for children to be read to with a lot of pictures. And it's a great book for people who love the flag that want to know a little bit more. About it.
That's awesome. That's you really you cool, had yeah. me at my name is Old Glory. Like the title just pulled right. me in. Yeah, that's what right, an awesome. Sure. And if for anyone that hasn't experienced one of those retirement ceremonies, I mean, it's one of those things that gives you chills every time that you see it. It's just, it's going to make, it will give you the feels no matter who you are, I think.
For sure.
Even if you've heard it 10,000 times, it's still a powerful thing, especially to watch the ceremony and the flag detail fold, you know, make each fold of the flag and treat it with the respect that they do as it passes from one hand to the next. Very cool. Well, Martha, do you have any parting shots for our listeners out there? And we will, guys, if, you know, I'm sure a lot of you are interested in the books. We'll link them everywhere that we've got a social presence and encourage you guys to go out and check them out. I've actually got and have had So Others May Live on my bookshelf for quite a long time, so I can attest to that. So it's a quality book. I am adding Old Glory to the library. One day I'll take a picture of this wall and let you guys see it. Kind of proud of my...
I think that's just because it has pictures, Phil. That's what had you about that's the Old what it Glory was,
dude.
One.
Dude, I'm proud of my Coast Guard library, man. I think you got to, you know, you got to have one. Just like, you know, they've said in the past, we encourage everybody to write about this service and get the word out because it's, the stories are not told unless someone gets out there and makes it happen. So Martha, we appreciate you telling those stories. And again, any parting shots for anyone?
Well, I just want to say the books are also audiobooks and electronic books. So if you are one that would prefer not to actually read it and flip through the pages, you can get them in other ways.
Are you reading them? Are you reading them, or is it like the Amazon voiceover thing?
Well, I made the mistake of, for this book, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice? And people said, if the author does some readings, it brings your audience closer. Mm-hmm. So I did the historical reading sections, and I hired a narrator for the other part. I got slammed in reviews.
Oh, really?
So I don't think I'll do narration again. I think...
You just got to read it, huh? Yeah, that's crazy. Cool. Who would have thought? Yeah,
that's not cool all right. At all.
So, hey, there's another one. If you guys get the audio book, give it some five stars.
Jim, the narrator for So Others May Live, does a fabulous job. Right. And then a gal did a wonderful, beautiful job for this book, Changing the Rules of Engagement. And those are the two that are audio books. Mm-hmm. So, parting shots. Hey, thank you both. For what you're doing. It takes a lot of work, a lot of effort behind the scenes, time that you could be spending with family or friends. And I really am thankful to be a part of your show and can't thank you enough for what you're doing to make a difference. Thank you. And all hail the Chiefs as they celebrate their 100 years of Chiefs and the Coast Guard. You guys are fabulous.
Solid ending, ma'am. Captain Kotai, we thank you for your time today. We thank you for your service to the country, and we thank you for continuing to remember the service of others. So stay healthy during this quarantine season. And if there's anything,
season, is that what we're calling,
it right now, because you know it's coming back, man. But if there's anything that we can do to help you going forward, just reach out and let us know.
Yeah, man. Thank you for your time today very much. We really appreciated it.
Thank you both. Thanks, appreciate it.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.